So let's begin by taking the precepts. Let's begin with Namo Tassa. Namo Tassa. Buddham saranam gacchami, Dhammam saranam gacchami, Sangham saranam gacchami, Dutiyampi Buddham saranam gacchami, Dutiyampi Dhammam saranam gacchami, Dhyatiyampi Sangham Saranam Gacchami, Tatiyampi Buddham Saranam Gacchami, Tatiyampi Dhammam Saranam Gacchami, Tatiyampi Sangham Saranam Gacchami, Panadip. Ida no silam, magapalanyanasa, pachyohotu, apamadena sambadeta. Sadhu. Bow three times. Mindfully, to quote a teacher we know very well. So today is July the 7th, 2004. Seattle has asked me to deliver the Dhamma talk tonight. And I'm going to pick up where he left off according to some instructions he gave me. Just a few notes for the yogis here. Seato has asked me to invite you all to practice, do your sitting practice in the meditation hall. He likes the synergy that arises when a group of seekers get together and practice. So please do that if you have any other, like it's his retreat and that's his call, so I'm the messenger here. If you want any other arrangements during your interviews with Seato, please discuss with him what to do. But you can walk wherever you feel comfortable for as long as you feel comfortable. Outside, there's some very good walkways. There's a myriad of great places to walk. But when you actually do your sitting practice, please mindfully come in here and settle in. So, you may remember, you may recall, Seato spoke fairly precisely about the sitting practice that we're engaged in. The beginning, of course, is metta practice for 20 minutes for specific individuals that you hold in high esteem. As Seato has mentioned, that will cool the mind, deepen concentration, and develop a loving kindness that will be very helpful for you as you then segue into your vipassana practice. So he spoke at detail about the sitting practice, the noting of the primary object of rising and falling, labeling it, as well as noting it. And just for semantics, when Seato mentions labeling, he's speaking directly of the process of subvocally labeling rising, rising, rising. But as he said earlier in his discussions with you, this is not vipassana. The labeling is not vipassana. The vipassana practice is the experiencing of the individual movements, or the experiencing and noting and being aware of the mental states as they arise and pass away. That is what he would define as noting. Labeling is the artifice, the tool that vipassana meditators use to bring the mind to the object clearly, and prevents the mind from getting mushy and sloppy and wandering all over the globe. So that's why that happens. He also spoke briefly about the importance of the five faculties that meditators might develop. I'm going to expand on that a little bit tonight. The five faculties a meditator must develop are, of course, sadha, faith, virya, which is effort, sati, mindfulness, and samadhi, concentration, from which will all arise panya, wisdom, insight into the true nature of mind and body processes. I'd like to, again, just elaborate on this to a certain extent, and then proceed to discuss the more precise details of walking and daily activities. Sadha, of course, is faith. It translates as faith. It's faith in the triple gems, of course. Faith in the teacher that is instructing you. Faith in the practice. And, of course, faith in yourself. Belief that you have the capability to do, to complete the practice. Now, strong faith is a very good antidote to wichikicca, to doubt. These five faculties, in fact, are strong antidotes to doubt and to the niwaran, the hindrances that meditators have to overcome, especially in the first few days of practice. So, clearly, all of you have enough faith to be here, to take some time out rather than going on a Club Med holiday. You came to a Club Meditation holiday, and that's a bad joke from India, isn't it? Yeah. So anyway, you're here clearly with a faith and a commitment. And, you know, I would echo that you're very lucky to be in the presence of Siaropia Ujanika, who is one of the, you know, two remaining chief disciples of the Venerable Mahasi Siado, who actually teaches, or actually there's three, there's Silananda as well, but I believe Upandita and Ujanika to be two of the greatest living masters of this particular practice. So here you are interviewing with him, listening to his Dhamma talks. Very, very auspicious time for all of you. Very lucky, because he is subject to anicca just like the rest of us. So while his health is good, you're fortunate yogis. So the faith is clearly strong enough. Now, there is a causal nature to these faculties, which all of you should know about. You all may know about it. I may be, again, preaching to the choir here, but it's important for all of you to be reminded that a strong faith, when faith is strong in both the triple gems, the practice and the teacher and yourself, it becomes the cause, and the effect becomes wirya, effort. Your effort will arise directly from the cause of faith. Now, the effort we're talking about is not just sort of lackluster, ordinary effort. In the scriptures, the sense of what the wirya that's necessary to make progress in this practice is summed up by the phrase viranam bhavo, which deals with the state of heroic ones. It's the place where the heroic warriors would exist. It's the state of mind that would elicit a heroic, strong, strenuous effort. Okay, so this is no small effort you need to exert here. So that when the effort is strong and strenuous and continuous, it becomes the cause. And that effort, the wirya, becomes the cause, and the effect becomes sati, mindfulness. So there's a causal relationship by the effort you bring to this practice and the wirya that that will arise from that effort. I'm sorry, the wirya is the cause, the effect is the sati becomes the effect. So there's a direct causal relationship between the wirya you bring and the sati that arises. Now, sati is in fact a state of mind. In the Abhidhamma, it's referred to as having a characteristic of non-superficiality, steadfastness, not a wobbliness. There's a steadfastness, a focus involved in the sati that is very important for this practice. Its proximate cause is a good effort and strong perception, and four foundations of mindfulness are as well a cause of sati. In other words, sati causes sati. Mindfulness causes itself. In other words, it's a vicious circle, not a vicious circle, a helpful circle that just keeps manifesting itself. I'd like to talk to you about some of the qualities that mindfulness that you must bring to this practice, some of the flavors, if you will, of the mindfulness that will be very helpful for you as meditators. The mindfulness will protect you and guard you and is diametrically opposed to the kilesa. Good mindfulness is a guardian for you, protecting you from all the possibilities of kilesas entering and further mucking up your mind. Mindfulness is a great protection for the meditators. So it's very important that you develop a continuity of mindfulness to be ever vigilant for those negative mind states that will arise and bite you. But it should have a quality of immediacy. In other words, the characteristic of the sati should be immediate, not delayed, not lazy, but immediately addressing the object of meditation. Now, it should be concurrent. It should arise at the same time that the object arises. So in other words, when the lifting is occurring in the foot, the awareness of lifting, the noting of lifting should occur immediately. And of course, the sati that we're looking for is extraordinary. It's not just your everyday kind of concentration that you engage in when you're driving to and from here. It's a sati that has to be steadfast, continuous, constant throughout the day, not just your ordinary spot concentration that comes and goes as needed. It also should have a characteristic of kind of rushing at the object of meditation, seeing it, somewhat like the analogy that's given is a crowd rushing to the gates of a theater to try to get in to see the show. The mindfulness should have that aspect of kind of flooding onto the object and seeing it. It should be firm as well. There should be a firm grasping and apprehending of the objects you're looking at. So if you're noting the rising and falling, you should be very clear as you possibly can be. When thinking arises, there should be a clear awareness, a clear mindfulness of the process of thinking as it occurs. It should envelop the object, sort of like treacle, molasses, envelop it and perceive it and apprehend it clearly. So it should have that flavor, that characteristic. As I've mentioned earlier, it's very important that the mindfulness be continuous throughout the day on all objects. We've mentioned that a number of times. The power of this practice is a continuity of mindfulness, of effort, which begets a continuity of mindfulness. Gaps in mindfulness, gaps in effort, causes a gap in concentration. And that's when that's when the concentration begins to leak away. So continuous is very important in this practice. Another very important thing, and a very difficult one, or a challenging one, let's say, for a lot of Westerners, was for this Westerner anyway, I'll speak from my own personal experience, is to have the sati be non-manipulative. In other words, we're not noting something, we're not being aware of something to change it. We're simply being aware of any object, mental, physical, or in the body or mind, to see it as it really is. We're not there to change it. We're not there to make the pain. We're not noting something to make the pain go away or to force thoughts from our head or to cut things off. We're simply there as very clear, firm, immediate observers of what is arising and passing away in our mental and physical processes. That's very important aspect of the sati, that the flavor that you must cultivate in your mind. Now, when sati is mature, strong, continuous, it becomes the cause, and the effect is deep, continuous, constant samadhi, concentration. And that's, it must be constant and continuous. No gaps. The concentration cannot be, there's no switch to turn on the concentration. You have to bring the effort. When you bring the effort, the mindfulness must be constant and continuous. And in due course, the concentration will be constant and continuous. And that's essential for this practice. And I'll get into a little more specifically how important that is in the daily activities and walking practice, the importance of keeping continuity of concentration. Very important. We'll fill in the blanks on that a little later. When samadhi is deep, penetrating, mature, it becomes the cause in conjunction with the effort, the mindfulness, and it becomes the cause of panya arising, wisdom. The insights that Seattle has spoken about arise when the concentration is continuous, deep, and penetrating. Now, the panya, there's really four types, which probably all of you know, but I'll summarize them for you. There's lokiya jnana, which is really mundane wisdom, and lokottara jnana, which is super mundane wisdom. The first type, there's actually four types. The first type is the worldly wisdom that we're all very familiar with in this room. It arises from the ability to learn a language, to deal in finance, to handle property, to run businesses, to do jobs, to drive, etc. This is worldly wisdom. It can be transferred and learned by analysis, by conceptualization, by learning, by study. Okay? So in other words, I could take this clock apart bit by bit, put it on a table in front of you, give you proper tools, verbally or in written form, instruct you as to how to put this watch back together, clock back together. And, you know, most of you could become semi-expert watchmakers just listening to me. You could understand what I'm talking about and reassemble this clock quite easily. That's the nature of the transfer of mundane worldly wisdom. It could be transferred verbally, orally, or in written form, or studied, conceptualized, and learned. So that's very intriguing to us because we've made our livings that way. We've become successful and we've made our way in this tough little world using the faculty of mind that learns, conceptualizes, analyzes, focuses, utilizes all the, integrates things, invents things. It's been very, for many of us, very satisfying. Now, the unfortunate news when you come to a Vipassana retreat is that faculty of mind, it does actually hinders any possibility of practice or any possibility of progress here. Much as we'd like to analyze our way to Nibbana, it ain't so. It can't happen. It would be nice, but it's not going to happen. The jnana up to and including Magapala jnana must be understood experientially. Any siado or any teacher could discuss each of the jnana and what happens, but it, unlike the watch or the clock analogy where an instructor would talk to you about the first jnana, for example, nama-rupa pratida jnana, it's going to do nothing for you. It'll sound good, sound maybe even logical, sound reasonable, but there's no real understanding of it. There's only a conceptual understanding, which is guaranteed to be incorrect. However, when you practice vipassana and experience this jnana for yourself, as it occurs once the mind is concentrated, once the faculties are strong, then you understand. You understand experientially, not intellectually. Well, experientially and intellectually. But you cannot grasp it intellectually and have any benefit from it. It's all experience. So therefore, the analytic mind contravenes the possibility of experiencing the jnana, because you cannot analyze your way to them, much as we'd like to. Okay. So, even though the first two types, the worldly wisdom and the vipassana jnana, are lokiya jnana, the jnana, the wisdom that arises from vipassana, must be experienced. Then the last two types of jnana, magga jnana, pala jnana, are super mundane. They're the direct experience of nibbana. And if a jnana cannot be discussed and understood, nibbana can't either. You must experience it for yourself. Okay? And it can be experienced. You know, these 13 jnana and the three following jnana, which are essentially the experience of nibbana, are real, attainable by yogis, attainable by people who practice diligently. They weren't made up just to sell books. It is doable. With persistent and good effort, these lokottara jnana can be experienced and understood directly. So that's my wish for you. Now, once jnana begins to arise experientially, it becomes the cause, the panya becomes the cause, and the effect is even deeper faith. So there's a circular nature of the five faculties, each one begetting and causing the next to arise. And so it's important for you to understand that faith will arise as experience in the Buddhist teaching arises. This is what vipassana really is, an opportunity for you to directly experience for yourself the teachings that the Buddha spoke about 2,500 or so years ago. Once you start to experience the teachings for yourself, the essence of the suttas, the experience that the words are alluding to in the suttas, then the faith becomes even stronger in the triple gems, okay? And kilesas begin to become weaker. The understanding of the mental and physical processes as just that, impermanent, unsatisfactory, and impersonal, becomes real for you, rather than just a concept that is read about in a book. So that's something that's very exciting about developing these faculties. The strong faculties have to be developed early in the practice. Now, of course, really, there's one other thing I want to touch on before I move on. Three of these faculties, the wirya, the sati, and the samadhi, are as well factors of enlightenment. They're part of a group of another seven factors of meditators must develop, the sambojana. So the other four, piti, pasadi, upeka, and dhamma vichaya, which are the four other sambojanas, factors leading to enlightenment, must be developed. Now, part of the reason we do metta is because if you practice metta clearly and deeply, or even to a certain level, you can attain relatively quickly a sense of piti. Rapture can arise. Calmness, pasadi, tranquility can arise as well. So I know Seattle likes to use metta because it helps in its way to develop two of the factors of enlightenment that will help provide a lightness of passage through the jnana, that of the piti sambojana and pasadi sambojana. So benefits or results that arise from a reasonably focused metta practice. Many of you have interviewed and have spoken of experiencing rapture in relatively short times. But even if you're not, you can still develop a calm and peaceful mind by doing metta, even the prior to the vipassana practice that you're engaging in. The other faculty that I think is worth, or the other factor that I think is worth mentioning, and I'm maybe throwing a bit of a shotgun approach here to you, but the factor that I really like in the seven factors of enlightenment is the Dhamma Vicaya, which is that investigative aspect of the practice. The part of the practice that the attitude to the practice where I am going to investigate my mental and physical phenomena thoroughly, using the flavors of this of the mindfulness that I discussed earlier. So, in other words, this attitude, this this way of approaching the practice as if it's a grand experiment. You know, the noting mind is the scientist. The mental and physical phenomena is the stuff that is being examined. The whole being is just a walking experiment. We as beings are experiment, are the experiment. But if you take the attitude that you're observing with a view to investigating and finding out what's going on in these mental and physical phenomena, these mind and body processes and activities that I've been very intimate with but ignorant of for X number of years, then that brings a sort of energy, an impulsion to the practice that I think is very useful, especially when the pain comes, when that boiling, bubbling, lava-like, piercing, twisting kind of stuff that may arise for the lucky ones in this room. That's when this investigative aspect investigative factor is very helpful, because you get to see one of the things we avoid with a passion in our life. Anything painful, we take a pill, run from it, have a shower, take a walk, take a drink, anything but watch physical pain. So if that ever arises, when it will, I hope, I wish pain for you. Awful thing to say, isn't it? I sound like a sadist and you masochist. But as Siero has said, this is the way to Nibbana. This is the key to Nibbana. When you're focusing, investigating, observing the pain, there's no thinking. There's no room for thinking. There's no sleepiness. There's no dullness of mind. You're simply there observing something that is very intense. So that's why the factor of enlightenment that we call Dhamma Vicaya, the investigative factor, will serve you very well. It'll tend to keep your attitude as one of fresh observation as you proceed in your practice. So that can actually be developed at any time. Just, make a resolution, a determination that that's what you're going to do. Treat this like a science experiment, something that you're looking at, something you're observing, learning about, that you've never had a chance before. A couple of things. There's a couple of factors that should be, a couple of faculties, two pairs of faculties that should be kept in balance. I'd like to speak specifically to one: effort and concentration should be in balance. And I'm saying this at this stage of the practice because I know many of you, all of you, are very keen meditators and very ambitious to make progress. And that's good. That has a sort of an impulsion that will assist you. But taken to an extreme, it can also become somewhat of a hindrance. So be aware of keeping your effort and your concentration in balance. Don't have too much. The most common problem at the early stages of a Vipassana retreat is too much effort and for the concentration that has developed. So you have to make sure at all times that your concentration and your effort are in balance. It's sort of like a water skiing, a boat with a water skier behind it. If you can picture a boat towing a water skier, at the beginning of the ride, the boat starts off slowly, gradually accelerating, but this water skier doesn't move, okay, until a certain time when the rope goes taut, and then gently the water skier is pulled up and breaches the water and then just glides on it. Okay. Similarly, too much effort is similar to a boat that just guns and swamps the water skier before it has a chance to get on top of the water. Okay. So the effort has to be balanced, because the concentration is not going to arise right away. But if you keep that effort and concentration in balance, then once the concentration catches up to the effort, you can spin across the lake, you can motor across the lake at 75 miles an hour, and the skier will follow, the concentration will follow. So just be aware of that. That's a very, I think, helpful thing to be aware of. The indicators that you've got too much effort and not enough concentration are dizziness, tension in the chest, and a headache. If you have any of those happening, if you feel any of that starting, just back off your effort a little bit. Give the water skier of concentration a chance to get up on top of the water. So just be aware of that. Once you get into this, once the motorboat and skier are cruising along the lake, it doesn't matter. You can give as much effort as you need, and the concentration will follow very quickly. So that's just a little warning. The other thing that happens might be a warning for some of the longer stay yogis. It's a rarer occurrence. Is too much concentration and not enough effort. This tends to happen when long-term yogis get to a place where, hey, it's easy, simple. I don't have to work as hard, and then they simply they get a little lazy. Essentially, their effort is not strong enough, and their concentration is too high. That's kind of a feeling of a malaise, ennui, serious restlessness. It's kind of a torpor. A very simple antidote to that is simply, amp up the effort, get the effort back in play. However, that's quite rare. So if any of the longer-term yogis are experiencing that, we can coach them back to balance. It's really about balance. That's what this practice is about. The other two factors or faculties that have to be in balance are faith and wisdom. If you have too much faith and not enough wisdom, then you become credulous, gullible, easily tricked. Seekers that, for example, the people that followed Jim Jones 25 years ago to Jonestown and took the cyanide-laced Kool-Aid and passed on to what he considered the only salvation, which was getting rid of the body was the way to freedom. The way to get rid of the body was to take cyanide. Well, 900 credulous people with huge faith in this man, but not much discernment, followed him to wherever they're ending up now. Not Nibbana. Certainly not Nibbana. But that's a gullibility if your faith is high and your wisdom low. The other side is if your wisdom is high and your faith is low, you turn into a crafty, skeptical kind of being, bent on easily falling into a skeptical doubt. In the Zen tradition, these are called the foxes, or, pardon me if there's any professors here, they're referred to as professors. I know there are some professors here, I'm sorry, but it's the Zen tradition, it's not me. Okay. The reason being, of course, that they're characterized as somewhat seeking to find holes or loopholes in the practice, seeking to debunk the teacher, seeking to prove that they're in fact right, that this is all hokum. They have a very clever minds, very, you know, fluid minds, but not much faith in what they're here for. So guess what? Self-fulfilling prophecy. It won't work for them. Nothing will happen. Their doubting minds will be right, so to speak. Haven't run into anybody here like that, but just a warning that that can happen. If you feel doubt arising, that's the place to note it very clearly, very, very crisply, very, very poignantly, so you don't fall into the problem of having overwhelming doubt just because you're having a bad day or a few overwhelming thoughts. Just note the doubt with your very focused mind. Watch it arise, see it in its true nature, watch it disappear. So, just to summarize, keep your effort and your concentration in balance, and just for interest's sake, faith and panya must be in balance. And of course, you can't have too much concentration. Okay, that's the you can have a warehouse full of concentration, and you won't harm yourself in any way, provided your effort matches it, of course. Now, having spoken somewhat of a general fashion about the practice, the need to have the faculty strong, firm, the causality, I'd like to spend a few minutes, a few more minutes on the specifics, specifically what's picking up from where Seattle left off, the walking practice. Now, walking, standing is one of the postures that we observe in this particular practice. Any of you have been instructed to note the left-right motion to begin with, perhaps moving to the lifting, pushing, dropping motion, ending up with lifting, pushing, dropping, touching. Now, if any of you are able to note intentions before any of these motions except the touch, or any of these movements except the touching, please do. If you need to note many liftings, lifting, lifting, pushing, pushing, dropping, dropping, touching, touching, do so. By doing this, we're examining the motion, the wind element, the movement element of the body. It's the primary object for the walking practice. As long as the foot is moving, it's a very simple process to note. If noted very clearly, it's possible to see the true nature of the wayodhatu movements, the many, many little movements that comprise what seems like, in normal daily life, a fluid gliding motion. So you can observe very clearly the movements of the foot, the lifting, the pushing, the dropping, the touching, and until some other more prominent object arises. And guess what that usually is? Guess. Thinking, yes. Thinking often takes over a walking practice. But no worries, because thinking is only a process. Thinking is simply a mental process, part of the citta nupassana group. If noted clearly, precisely, immediately, and energetically, it can be observed in its true nature. Okay? So if the thinking occurs in a sort of superficial way and one noting while you're moving is enough to watch it disappear, that's fine. If it's somewhat overwhelming, or there's a string or a chain of thoughts arising, stop, note thinking until it disappears, and then observe its disappearance, and then return to the lifting, pushing, dropping, or whatever your object of noting is. You may also, hearing may be strong. There's birds and noise around, and if that's predominates or dominates or is predominant over the moving, the motion aspect, simply note hearing until it fades and disappears, or the mind loses interest in it and it becomes imperceptible, then return to the lifting, pushing, dropping. It's important to label, especially at the outset of the practice, so that your mind can be brought very attentively and clearly to the vayodhatu of the walking practice, the lifting, pushing, dropping, touching. Certain times you may not need to label. You may need only to note or observe and experience the motion of the foot. But be a little careful of that, because sometimes the mind can get a little soggy around the difference between lifting and the difference between pushing and the difference between dropping and the sensation of touching. We can think we're doing it, but it's kind of soggy. So if you feel your mind getting kind of soft or not so focused on the actual movements, make sure that you're labeling clearly what is happening, and immediately what is happening, the lifting, the pushing, the dropping, the touching. This practice should be done for an hour. You may notice other things that arise, some energies around the foot or vibrations or whatever. Observe them and then return to the motion of the foot as the primary object. When you're walking, and this is just a little, you can develop very deep concentration. There have been yogis in ancient times, and even yogis today, that have developed insight or had jnanas arise as a result of the walking, certainly. Some have even attained nibbana by the walking practice itself. So don't discount walking. It's a very, very, it's a very, very important part of this practice. There's essentially three parts to this stool. There's the walking, sitting, and daily activities. So you must have all three strong, must be engaging in all three practices strongly and clearly. So don't discount the walking. It's very important. When you do develop concentration, and as you feel yourself ending the practice of walking and moving towards the sitting cushion, something that worked very well for me, it was continue to note the movements of the foot as you approach your cushion. And when you get close to the cushion, I find shut the eyes, and note the positioning of the body as it bends and turns, and the legs and arms moving with your eyes closed, labeling everything until you get yourself comfortably in position. I find that it's been found that this maintains the continuity of mindfulness and concentration from the walking practice into the sitting practice. So it's a very helpful little tool. Try to have your hands in front of you or in the back or crossed. Don't try to avoid walking with your hands hanging, because if you do that, they'll puff up like balloons. Not in a few days, but over the course of the retreat, you could find yourself with a couple of Michelin balloons on the end of your wrist. And that's a whole bunch of dukkha you don't need. You got enough to work with. So keep your arms comfortably in front of you, head and shoulders comfortably erect, eyes tilted downward and looking about 2 meters or 6 feet in front of you. Okay, don't tilt your head forward. Hold your head comfortably erect and tilt your eyes downward. That's the way to do it. Good posture will prevent injury or undue stress arising in the neck. Okay, move slowly. Move slowly and mindfully noting all actions and movements of the foot. So that you can see the true nature of the movements of the foot, so that you can develop concentration, deepening concentration. Once you've moved to the sitting practice, follow Seato's instructions that I summarized earlier. And then I'd like to get to the daily activities, which Seato will tell you is the second most important aspect of this practice. The first being thinking. Noting thinking is the most important thing a meditator can do. Noting the process of thinking. Thinking is not a problem for a meditator. It's getting lost in thought that kills meditators. Okay? That's when you die. That's when you're DOA as a meditator, when you get lost in the movies or the DVDs that are running in your head. And thinking has a habit of linking up like chain link fences, like a chain link fence. One thought begets another, begets another, begets another, begets another. And in extreme cases, I've experienced at, you know, retreats in other parts of the world, I get a yogi in front of me with their bags packed with a story about having to go home because they didn't note the thinking that started off with, oh, it's hot here. Oh, I'm uncomfortable. Oh, why am I here? Oh, it would be nice to be home in a hot bath. Oh, goodness, I forgot to feed my goldfish. I'll tell you what I should do. I have to get home. I got to get out of here. I'll tell the monk that I have an emergency and I have to leave. Pack my bags, get out of here. And if they just noted it's hot here, hot, thinking, they wouldn't get to the place where they're in front of me with a packed bag telling me they have to feed their goldfish or some such thing. So noting thinking is very important because these thoughts will spread into a whole story, which at best, will distract you and cause your meditation to sink. At its worst, of course, you have to make up a story to get out of the place or make another story up. So that's why thinking is very important to note in all aspects of the day. And not note to get rid of, note to see in its true nature. It is a legitimate and bona fide object of meditation. The thinking process is just as good as rising, falling, lifting, pushing, dropping, anything else. Pain. It has the unfortunate characteristic of being able to suck you in and, you know, interest you in the movie. Okay, it's playing, now playing. What you did when you were three. Again, okay? And in you go. But noting the process of thinking, you'll gradually become very, very focused and able to see the thoughts before they even concretize into something. You won't even know what they are, and you'll note them and they'll disappear. You'll see them in their true nature. Thinking is truly impermanent. It's not you, and it's 95% of it is suffering, and the other 5% gets you here and there. Okay? But almost all of it is unsatisfactory. Okay? And many of you have expressed that to me in very, you know, colorful ways in your interviews. Okay? So thinking must be noted. Now, you know, some yogis have said, Bhante, I had to spend 45 minutes standing, noting thinking, thinking, disappear, begin to walk up, thinking, disappear. Is that a problem? I said, no, that's very important, that you're still meditating as long as you're noting the process of thinking until it disappears. You're still meditating. It's strengthening the focus of the mind. So no, you're into a place where you just happen to be having a batch of the process of thinking, of the citta nupassana to go through. Okay? Far worse to get lost in any one of those thoughts. Okay? So Just note thinking as it arises, when it arises, attentively, energetically, and immediately, and begin to see it in its true nature. Because the thinking mind, the noting mind, will overwhelm the thinking mind. Thinking is also one of the sense doors we love to play in, because it's instant sense gratification in any form that you want. So it's one of the hindrances that we have to be careful and guard against. It's one of the major sense doors to guard against. So, the second most important thing to note is to slow down in daily activities. Slow down so that you can maintain the continuity of mindfulness and concentration throughout the whole day. Now, this is again antithetical to what we're used to in the daily busy world. We make our livings going fast, catching taxis, serving clients. We have been well served by our speed in the mundane world. Here, thanks for playing, but speed, as I said earlier, kills meditators' concentration. But again, you have to be patient with yourself, because you don't force it. Just, I hate to use the word organically, but naturally and gently slow yourself down to become a snail. The sooner the better, the slower the better, you know. But again, because, you know, you're coming from very fast-paced lives, just do it gently. Be slower tomorrow than you were today, slower this afternoon than you were this morning. And the way to do it is to begin noting more actions and movements. As soon as you begin labeling more actions and movements, the stretching, the twisting, the bending, the turning, the squeezing, the touching, then you automatically have to slow down. Okay? So noting gradually more and more actions and movements in all aspects of the daily life will assist you greatly in slowing down. As I've said to many of you, three or four areas that are particularly good are to eat mindfully, and I'll demonstrate an eating meditation in a few minutes. There'll be a mythical bowl of mangoes in front of me, and I'll eat them for you in a minute. But eating is a great place to slow down. Bowing to the Buddha before and after your practice is a very simple place to begin to slow your daily activities down. As you come to a door, noting the stretching motion, or even if you can, note the intention before the stretching motion, the stretching, the squeezing, the turning, the coolness, the bending, will assist you in slowing down. Very important that you slow down and see the true nature of actions and movements throughout the day. Also, as you move around from here to your bedrooms, or bedrooms to here, or here to the dining hall, noting left, right is useful, but it's still a bit of a leak. It's still a little fast. If you can move no faster from here to there by noting lifting, pushing, dropping, then your concentration will be sort of maintained. If you want to make it slower and make it essentially a part of your walking practice, that's okay as well. In the washrooms, the toilets, the showers, the beds, start to note as many actions and movements as you can when possible, okay? As you can, just gradually slow down. Because the daily activities are essentially the linchpin between walking and eating and, walking and sitting. Most people think, I got to hurry up and get to the meditation hall so I can be mindful. It doesn't make sense. Be mindful getting to the meditation hall, and then continue to be mindful when you're in the meditation hall. So that's why daily activities are very, very important. Shiata will say that if you don't slow down in daily activities, don't expect much progress in this practice. Those who aren't prepared to slow down will not experience much in this practice. Whereas those who are willing to will be amazed at how deep the concentration and how penetrating the insights will be. So again, it's the spinning fan analogy which I spoke to you the other day about. A spinning fan, the object of meditation, the object of vipassana is to see the true nature of mental and physical phenomena. If we analogize ourselves to a spinning fan, when the fan is spinning, it looks like a solid disc, which is not the true nature of a fan. Okay? So a speedy meditator will never see the true nature of the mind and mental and physical phenomena. Okay? But if we turn the fan off or slow it down and we begin to see the blades, which is the true nature of a fan, three to five blades make up most fans, then the slowness of the spinning fan allows us to see the true nature of the fan. Similarly, a snail-like yogi will begin to see the true nature of mental and physical phenomena much more clearly and with deeper concentration. Okay, slowing down automatically brings the mind to concentration. So that's why Seattle and I will say several dozen times over the next while, slow down, slow down. Gently inviting you to slow down. Great benefits will arise because that's the third component of this practice, daily activities, noting the daily activities. Now, to give you a graphic demonstration, Seattle asked me to demonstrate hypothetical eating here. Okay? So pretend there's a bowl of mangoes here, and I'm going to eat them. I'm not going to break my vows, don't worry. There's no mangoes here. I'm not breaking the Vinaya, don't worry, Bhante. Okay. But anyway, I would sit and I would note the seeing. I would be seeing. I would also note desire, which is arising, because I happen to like mangoes. I would also then note the intention and the lifting of the arm, the bending, the intention, bending. The intention, stretching. Intention, scooping. And then I might note seeing again. Intending, bending. Intending, opening. Intending, placing, touching. Intending, closing of the mouth, pop. Intending, stretching. Intending, dropping, touching. At that time I will suggest closing the eyes, so intention, closing, intending, chewing. At this point, there's going to be taste probably arise. I'll note tasting. If I'm very sharp, I'll note that there's also an intention to swallow. Look, swallowing. I'll note the sensation of swallowing. Intending, opening. Seeing. And then we begin again. That's a sort of a very advanced type of noting that would occur at a meal. So I don't expect necessarily all of you immediately to be able to do it that slow. But that's the precision of noting that is very helpful in the practice. The noting of intention before as many actions and movements as you can, the noting and labeling of all the movements that occur, and the sensations and the desires that arise as a result of the contact with the various foods. Mm-hmm. So that would be an eating practice, and that could take you an hour to eat a meal. As I said this morning, it doesn't matter anymore. Take your time. If you want to take an hour to eat the meal mindfully in the way I describe, that will enhance the practice. You'll also come in contact with the aspect of greed. We are very greedy people in North America when it comes to food. We have a conveyor belt to our mouths usually, swallowing without even hardly enjoying the food. This will help. That's an antidote to this greed, the slowness, the noting of the greed, the noting of the desire, the understanding of the wholesomeness of hunger versus the unwholesomeness greed for food. We come in contact with a lot of mind states if you slow down around eating. And of course, the more aspects you're noting, the deeper the concentration and the more continuous the concentration. Now, one other thing that I was asked to before I end tonight, because as Seattle would say, enough for tonight, but there's one other thing that one yogi asked me to explain, how to take rest. One of the things that befuddled my early practice with when I was practicing with Seattle was I would practice fairly diligently in the morning. I would actually eat fairly mindfully, as demonstrated, and I found that my concentration was deeper at the end of lunch than it was at the beginning, except that I was a little tired and I needed to take rest at lunch. So what I was doing was going home and kipping out, sacking out for 45 minutes or an hour, falling asleep. And I was finding it very difficult to practice in the afternoon because I was sluggish. And sleep had essentially caused the concentration to leak. It leaked out and it was like a hissing sound leaking away from me. No, that's not true. It wasn't a hissing sound, but it did leak. So Seattle told me and gave me very good advice. He said, what'll help you both rest and maintain your concentration is a practice of sitting upright against the back of your bed or the wall with your legs stretched out, hands in the meditation, left under right, and simply close your eyes and note the rising and falling of the abdomen. And if you happen to doze off or go into dreamland, you may be able to note the little border between wakefulness and sleepiness, sleep. You may be able to note that. But I found at the end of it all, this posture of sitting, taking rest, maintained concentration to a good degree. Not much was lost. My mind was refreshed, and my body was refreshed. Now, this was when I had a fairly old model, a 45, 40-year-old model when I was practicing with Seattle. So I needed to take a little rest from time to time. Okay, a little rest, but not, I didn't need to lose concentration. I didn't need to go to sleep. I just needed to let the mind and body refresh itself. That was my particular Dhamma, my makeup. Many of you are, I think, 50-year-old models now and may feel the need to take rest. This is a very good way to do it at lunch without dissipating that hard-won concentration that you've gained. Okay? So that's a good, efficient way to take rest, which will still allow you to maintain the continuity of mindfulness and the continuity of concentration. Okay? So I just offer that to you. Direct from Seattle. He has instructed me, he saved my practice, really. Because from then, my strongest part of the meditation period in the day was in the afternoon, because I was really clear and focused. The afternoon became the best part of the day for me because of that. I might arise and take a quick shower and then off to the meditation hall. So, I think that's enough for tonight. Yes, it is. So I may all of you rightly understand, rightly develop the faculties of a meditator, faith, effort, mindfulness, concentration, and ultimately wisdom. May you rightly understand the techniques that Seattle and I have given you. May you rightly apply them to your practice. May this application bring you progress. May that progress be the basis for your attainment of Nibbana. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.